Billy Billingham grew up tough, a grim future ahead of him offering little respite from the hostile streets he walked. Leaving school at 11 years of age, the threat of bull still hanging over his head, running with gangs in Birmingham and almost being killed in a knife fight led to Billy discovering the British Armed Forces at 16. It would be the making of him. You will know him from TV's SAS Who Dares Win. You'll also know him as Mark Billy Billingham. He's written the book The Hard Way. Delighted to be joining me live on the UK line from the UK. I will call you Billy, shall we? Good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles. Yeah, Billy's fine, mate. Everyone knows me as Billy. Indeed. The only person that calls me Mark is family, really.
Right then, Billy it is. Good to have you with us. I wasn't aware. I mean, I know you from the Who Dares Win, the TV series with Ollie Ollerton and the rest of the guys, but quite an amazing story. You left school at 11.
13, actually, mate. It was 13.
Right.
I just started playing truant thereafter, and I used to go once a week for the rest of the time for just to be picked for the football team.
Right.
I was terrible.
What area of Birmingham are you from?
I'm actually from Walsall, just outside of Birmingham.
Yeah.
Walsall, West Midlands. Yeah, and a place called Coldpool.
And tell me a little bit about life then. I mean, you said it was a tough upbringing. I mean, just explain a little bit what ways it was tough and why you found yourself, if you like, you know, did you have to toughen up? Were you a bit directionless? I mean, what happened and what shape? You know, give me the quick heads up over.
Yeah, we were quite a big family, a family of five, and the area was pretty poor. It's council estate. You know, there weren't a lot of work around. Mum and Dad, fortunately, were working. They were working 12-hour shifts, but I guess back in the day, we didn't realise that money must have been terrible. I mean, we never even had... We had a TV. We didn't have a licence. Every time that somebody knocked the door, my daddy used to pull a plug off and put a cover over it because we couldn't afford the licence. There was a lot of gangs around at the time. And, you know, I was sort of one of the younger lads that immediately sort of attracted myself to the gangs, trying to make a name for myself as being somebody, thinking getting in trouble and fighting and stuff was the way ahead. You know, and obviously I'll learn later on that's another way, but that's the sort of lifestyle we had. You know, we were constantly out sort of all hours of the night, all through the day, the night, never sort of contactable, unlike today, you know, totally different world. And yeah, it started to get a little bit rogue. I was getting in trouble all the time, fighting. As you've already alluded to, I got stabbed at the age of 15. I was in court at the age of 11 for a number of things, including ABH. Yeah, I went totally rogue, thinking it was the right thing to do.
What, I mean, was it getting stabbed that was the moment that you thought, I mean, you were already 15, you know, that I've got to do something to change my life? Because a lot of people would just brazen that out and descend further into the gang lifestyle.
No, I think I went wayward on and off all the way through, and the reason I wrote the book is about influential people in my life. And the first one was boxing, believe it or not. You know, a guy got me into boxing, he taught me discipline, he taught me respect. But then I was using the skills that I'd learned in the boxing ring out in the street. And then I got into the cadets. I met a guy who was the second influential man in my life, really, who educated me towards the military. And the stuff he was teaching me, or the cadets were teaching me, seemed to make sense to me. You know, it was like first aid, saving lives, reading a map. Whereas school at the time, learning about, you know, English apostrophes and grammar didn't make a lot of sense. So I kind of gravitated that way. And I bounced in and out of trouble, getting put back on the rails. And then at the age of 15, it went really wrong. You know, I ended up in a fight and I got stabbed. And I think, if I'm honest, it was one of the closest at the time moments of feeling like I'm going to die. I remember crawling back to the house and virtually going unconscious with the blood that I lost, thinking I have to do something now. And I kind of stayed out of trouble for a while, and I got a job in a factory, legal, at the age of 16, and I was working nights. And I met another old guy who says, you have to go into the army. You know, that is your life. So, and that was it then. I was fully focused on running the military.
I mean, you didn't do things by halves, did you? Because you went into the Royal Marine Cadets for a start, which must have been a bit of a wake-up call.
Yeah, that was our local cadets, Marine and Sea Cadets. And like I say, the guy in charge was a guy called Matt Gaunt, and his two sons are good friends of mine. One went into the Royal Marines and served in the Falklands War, and the other one went into the Guards and only literally just finished his career a couple of years ago. He did 35 years. So, yeah, and all the young kids before me did the same. And it was just before the Falklands that I was due, sorry, just after the Falklands that I joined. And, you know, it was that time when all the guys came back and he kind of sat there listening to all their stories, and I thought, God, this is, I need this. This is where I need to go. And it was, and it was most certainly for me the right choice.
I mean, a lot of thing with the military is they break you down to build you up again. How did you, as you know, a guy who'd been running around in gangs before, how did you take to that? I mean, were you did you see the big picture, or did you just take it as a personal affront they were trying to get on your back?
Well, I'll be honest. I think at that time I realised I was a small fish in a big pond. I always thought I was somebody tough and all the rest of it, but I was now walking around men who were real tough guys. You know, they'd been to war, they'd done what they had to do, and they experienced a lot of life all around the world already. So very, very good, hard, experienced people. And I realised I was in a different league. And it was kind of time to sort of shut my mouth, wind my neck in, and start learning. And every day was a challenge to me to really to stay on the rails, keep my mouth shut, and keep up with everybody else. I was the youngest person there, or second youngest, I think, but and second skinniest. So every day was hard for me. I was looking around, and as you do, you judge other people and think, wow, how am I going to keep up with these? But you kind of grow mentally and physically day by day as you watch people that you think are better than you fall by the wayside. And after about a month, I remember looking around, and there was only three quarters of the platoon left. And I think, wow, I'm still here. I started to grow and mature, I guess, and realize, you know, I've got to give this 100% and do the right thing. And it was most certainly the best thing I ever did.
And you went into the parachute regiment as well. How did they take to a Royal Marine cadet joining the parachute regiment?
I'll be honest, I look back at it, and yeah, they found out I was a Marine cadet. So every day, the physical training instructor we had, one of them was a guy called Gaz. I won't mention his last name because he might not want me to.
Right.
And he had arms the size of legs, and they were huge. And he used to just stand in front of us and go, "You've got to have big arms to crush a Marine's head." And he'd go, "Right, come out here, fishhead." And he'd call me out. And he'd use me as an example to throw around, like, you know. So it was kind of fun Mickey taking, if you like. But he's pretty tough. You know, I got a lot of stick for being a Marine cadet going to the parachute regiment.
And, I mean, the parachute regiment, aggressive infantry, basically. I mean, they're the first in. They are your shock troops. It is a completely different mindset, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I mean, we do different things differently, you know. And I remember people saying, "God, paras, they think they're great. They think they're this. They think." And I thought, you know what? Yeah, they do. They really believe in themselves, you know. And I think for the job that they do, you need to. You need to have that self-belief and that confidence. And they do. And it's, you know, it sometimes gets spilt out in the wrong areas when they've had a few beers downtown. But, you know, and for what they do, for the, you know, the conflicts they have to be involved in and the work they have to do around the globe, they're perfect troops for it.
From there, from, you know, just being in distinction with the paras and being, were you a platoon leader, a patrol commander, excuse me, you decided to take it the step further, which is, you know, the hardest club in the world to join, the SAS.
Yeah, I did 9 years with the parachute regiment and ended up back in the depot where it all began, the factory, as they call it, you know, training the recruits. And I'd realised before I went to the depot that I wanted to go to the next level up, which was, to me, was the SAS. You know, a lot of paratroopers before me, to mine, had gone there, didn't really know what they were doing. I knew they were doing good stuff. And I just thought, I've got to get there. I've got to do it for me. One, because I want to do it. Two, to prove if I can do it. And that's exactly what I did. I waited till I'd done my 2 years plus at the depot as an instructor and applied before I went there. And then I eventually got put on the course in the winter of 92. I was supposed to go in the summer of 91, but at the time there was more of a commitment to be for the training side of it, so they kept me there for 6 months extra, but it worked out perfectly, really.
This is a bit of a stupid question, if you excuse me, but with the SAS training, I mean, presumably, can anybody, I mean, not, let me get this right, if you are if you're in the army, can any branch of the army apply to go to the SAS, or do you have to have done a certain level of training before they even look at you?
No, it's tri-service, which means, you know, Army, Navy, Air Force, anyone can apply for it. As long as you have done, it used to be, I think it was between 5 and 6 years service with whatever unit you're with, and supposedly at least one operational tour, Northern Ireland or Cyprus or wherever that may be. I know the rules have changed slightly now because, you know, times are different, and they realise the kind of recruitment age was around about sort of 24 upwards, and then they realise by the time you've reach, you know, you're 22 years in the military, everybody's around about 40 years old, and you kind of being put out the door, and you've still got a lot of experience and a lot of time to give. So they drop the age, looking for younger guys. Not the standards. The standards will always be the same, you know. But and I think you don't have to have 5 years now. You might be able to go after 3 years of being in the military. But you have to be in a military unit of some sort before. And yes, right. Army, Navy, or Air Force. It's open to all.
And was it as, you know, that first day of, you know, when you're training or you're doing the selection course, is it as, you know, it's got a reputation. I mean, did you, but you'd been a, you know, you'd been in the paras, you'd been training, surely. Was it as fearsome as you thought it might be?
Yeah, I mean, the selection process was. I kind of went, I'd got 9 years experience under my belt. I'd been to the jungle. I've done, I was probably as fit as I could be because I was, like I say, I was training recruits. And I went with the wrong sort of mindset because I thought, right, if I can get through the hills phase, which is the first phase, which is over the mountains, you know, carrying the house on your back and all the navigation, I'll be fine. I've done the jungle before. I like the jungle. It'd be all right. I was totally not ready for it. The jungle is selection, not the hills. The hills phase, you know, you don't really get looked at because there's so many people turn up. And I think on day two of mine, 83 went. We lost 83 on day two. So they don't even look at anyone until they get to the jungle phase. By then, the numbers are smaller and you're put into patrol and then it's about soldiering. It's about what you're really like as a character. I wasn't ready for that. I was expecting just a normal jungle patrolling, but you are, it's probably the most physical and mental demanding thing I've ever done in my life. And you're watched 24 hours a day, literally. And the thing about it, the hardest thing about it really is it's all about self-motivation. You're not encouraged or decouraged. So you don't really know how you're getting on. And if you've made a minor mistake, it kind of plays on your mind and it escalates because you think, oh, I've been seen. Are they going to fail me for that? And you end up beating yourself up. And then on top of that, the physical and the mental side of it is just horrendous. And it's, you know, 5-6 weeks solid.
I mean, people talk about, you know, finding reserves of character when you were, you know, that they didn't know they had it. And a lot of it being, you know, physical pain is actually an awful lot to do with the mental pain, etc. And after the jungle and after you joined the regiment, as it's known, did the challenges turn out to be everything you expected?
Yeah, it was after police selection, you realise it's called SAS selection. There's nothing special. It's special forces selection. There's nothing special forces about selection. Selection is about choosing people for special forces work. And then, you finally get to the end of it. And I think 180-something or 200-something started and 7 of us finished, plus 2 officers. And then you walk into this world, and it's a different world. This old world opens up, you know. And as an example, I mean, you arrive there and straight away you fit in. It's not like joining the normal army where you start right at the bottom of the pile. You're expected to have some input. You're expected to, you know, come up with ideas and get involved. And from the first moment I got there, I mean, I think within the first month I was in a foreign country I'd never heard of before on operation. Then I was back in UK. Then I was at the Royal London Hospital working as a doctor after doing a 10-week course. And then the next thing I was operating a chainsaw, I was doing all sorts of stuff, and it all becomes relevant to stuff you're going to do around the world. It's a totally different world. You're working at strategic government level, you know, so you realise, wow, it's time to, people are going to listen to what you've got to say, and you've really got to be on top of your game.
And you served 17 years in the SAS, and you ended up being a sergeant major and picking up an MBE as well, which, you know, was the icing on the cherry on the cake.
Yeah, I mean, I say 17 years, it's actually longer than that. I think 17 years as what they call sort of Sabre squadron type work, which is the tier one. And then, you know, I did a number of years after that where I just stayed on and went out to the jungle school as a sergeant major. I then did what they call the LDEP, which is the Air Readiness Reserve. So you're still part of the unit, but not as active. So, yeah, and then, I was fortunate enough I picked up an MBE for operation stuff in London. But, yeah, it was an interesting time. It was good.
After you left the army, you went a little bit glitzy. You went to Hollywood, but not as an actor, as a close personal protection specialist. Otherwise, you know, a bodyguard. Who did you? You've quite a few characters you bumped into over there as well.
I did. Yeah, I mean, just prior to leaving, I did a bit of moonlighting. I sort of felt the ground to see what I wanted to do when I left. Security was always probably in the domain because it's what I know well. And, yeah, I ended up looking after a number of celebrities, you know, from Russell Crowe, Tom Cruise onwards. And then I took a full-time job with the A-list Brad and Angie for a while, for a couple of years. And that was really my first time full-time job after the military, which was bizarre because I went from sort of the clandestine, you know, denying whole life of what you're doing, where you are, to in every blooming magazine, which you couldn't avoid. So it was a different lifestyle. It was weird, but it was great. It was a great time.
Tom Cruise's name pops up, and I interviewed some people who worked with him on the Mission Impossible films, and they said he's, you know, they were the guys who were doing the jumps with him. And they said he's absolutely, you know, great fun, but absolutely crazy.
I mean, I didn't decide. I worked on it. It wasn't a particularly long time. It was a, you know, to cut a short period of time, and to me, he was brilliant. I met him, and it was like I knew him. He was very respectful. He had his work to do, I had my work to do. He respected what I had to do, and he wanted me to sort of try and ensure that he could do what he needed to, all his meetings, all his film stuff. And yeah, he was, you know, he's like everybody. We've all got our own little sort of weird ways of doing things, but it never affected me. He never showed anything to me that was weird. He was good. He was really good. He was a good guy to work for.
Tell me a little bit about then what your original thoughts were when you were approached to be on TV. You said you'd be, you know, a bit surprised to see yourself, you know, in the newspapers and the magazines. So the offer of TV comes in, and SAS Who Dares Wins. I mean, what was your original thought? You know, oh, they're going to try and sort of glamorize what we do. It's going to end up like the film, the Lewis Collins film.
Yeah, that was a weird thing as well. I before that, I actually got offered a job, which I actually did it. It was a film called Unbreakable, which was about 5 or 6 years before that, while I was working with Brendan Angie as I came, I just about finished. And it was about pushing a bunch of fit people, male and female, through, similar to what they're doing now, through the jungle phase. And, you know, I'm supposed to break them, and they're unbreakable, which took about 40 minutes, and I had to really think it, because I did warn the producers that it would be a little bit more difficult than they expected, and proved it. And once I'd done that program, I didn't feel comfortable with working that side of the camera. I didn't like it, because it didn't feel good to me. And I left it for a long time, and then I got approached a number of times after, would you come out, do this program, do that program? And I said no, and then I got two calls in 1 week, believe it or not, and one was for SAS Who Dares Wins, and it was the first one, just as it was about to be put together. And it was a good friend of mine, Colin, who was on the first program, and he said, hey, we're putting this program together, blah, blah, blah. And I said, what is it? And he said, SAS Who Dares Wins. And as soon as I heard the name, I thought, nah, I'm not doing it. There had been so many sort of weird, sort of strange programs of the regiment by people that are not regiment and coming out with all crazy stuff. I thought, I don't want to be part of that. So I said no. And I left it. And I was going to do another program called SFI Tough Enough with Freddie Flintoff for, I think it was Channel 5 or something. Anyway, whoever it was. No, BBC. Right. And long story short, I was going to do that because I thought, well, it's not really SAS. It's about a number of different countries being put through tests. I don't mind doing that. Long story short, I ended up with malaria. I didn't do it. I ended up in hospital, and didn't happen. At the same time, SAS Who Dares Wins went out, and both programs went out, and SAS Who Dares Wins actually got great ratings, and it was really good, apparently. I didn't see it. And then I got a call from the producer from the show saying, hey, we really want you to come on SAS Who Dares Wins Series 2. To the point where I said, no, he can't bear to talk to me. And I said, I'll tell you what, I'll have a look at it. I had a look at it, watched it. I thought, you know what, actually, it's not about four so-called special forces guys. It's about the people. And it's about us giving back a bit of knowledge of experiences we've been through, something similar to what they can relate to. And I kind of liked it. So I thought, okay, I'll give it a go. And then I joined them on Series 2, and I enjoyed it. It was like being back in the mob to a degree. You know, we had banter and fun, and there's no script to it. There's no rehearsals. It is what it is. And we just get to push people through their paces to not break them down, because I don't like that word. We don't break people down. We sort of strip them back to their real character, to a place they've never really been and they really want to find out. And I think if you spoke to anybody that's been on the show, everybody that's been on it's come back out of it a better person.
I mean,
really learned a lot about it.
This is the thing, isn't it? Because it'd be very easy for people to go in and do drill sergeant and scream and shout at people until they absolutely crack. But the important part of the thing is that if you're going to get people to push themselves beyond the limits, you've got to strip them back, but you've also got to encourage them and build them up as well.
Exactly, and it's that, you know, not breaking them down, it's pushing them through barriers that they're uncomfortable with. It's getting them into their own comfort zone, and making them realise, actually, you know what, I can go a little bit further, I can do a little bit more. And it takes a while to get that. And once they get to that point, then we build them straight back up. Stosh can do it. Give them the confidence, and we get great results out of it. You know, a lot of people fall by the wayside. A lot of people can't, you know, motivate themselves enough to go. They really do. If their mind goes, they lose their mind on it and feel, I can't do it, then, you know, you won't do it. The body will go further than the mind. As long as you've got the mind working, the body will go with it to a degree.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because the series has been a massive hit, and yet we are, you know, we're always getting things about obesity and people not wanting to self-start and not getting the levels of fitness up. Do you think that that was one of the reasons that you wanted to prove that people should and could be able to do it with the book?
Yeah, it is. I mean, the book is about my journey, my trials and tribulations, and it's just saying, no matter what it is, I'm saying to people, listen, if I can do it, you can do it. You know, I achieved goals that I'd been told I'll never reach. I didn't believe myself I'd reach, but I didn't know that till I went for it. And I went for it. And as long as, you know, in your mindset, you feel, if I put my mind to it, I go for it, at least I'll stand a chance. You know, there's the old saying, people say, well, if you put your mind to it, you can achieve anything. That's not true. You can't. But I'll tell you what you can do. By putting your mind to it and stepping over the start line, you will definitely be in a better place than sitting there and not doing anything about it. That's for sure. And that's what I've always believed. And when the chips are down, and it's getting tough, and I'm starting to think I've bit off more than I can chew. You know, I just, instead of taking it day by day, hour by hour, I take it minute by minute, and I just keep going. And I always say to myself, it's a passage in time. Soon this will be over. Soon it'll be done. Keep going, and just keep it. Always go that little bit further. Keep going until you really can't go anymore. And I've always had that sort of mentality, and books about it. It's about giving back and teaching people, or telling people, listen, you can. It's amazing what you can do. It's easy to say no and I can't, but you'll be surprised. And you do need self-motivation. You've got to get up and want to do it. There is, everybody wants a six-pack. Well, if you want a six-pack, start doing crunch-ups and sit-ups and work on it. There ain't going to be no tablet that's going to come along and you can get it overnight. It ain't going to happen. You've got to work. You've got to go for it.
What was your, the book's called The Hard Way. I'll ask you two final questions, Billy, because I know you're a busy guy, but what was your, let's do two final questions. What was your hardest time, and what's been your highest time, your best time thus far? We'll start with the hard one first.
I think the hardest time was when I joined the parachute regiment at the age of 16 or 17. You know, I've never been away from home. I never travelled outside of Warsaw. It was all alien to me. I was around people with a lot more experience. I had the wrong mindset initially. So that was tough. It was really hard. And the night before I went, I had a good old chat with my dad, and I was like, not really sure whether I could do this. I think the chat with my dad put the fire up my backside to go, you know what, I'm going to prove everybody wrong, prove my dad, me, myself, right, and prove my dad wrong. And he wasn't doing it to make me, you know, fail. He wanted to push me. He was his way of saying, get out there and prove it. So that was hard. That was a real tough time. I think the best times probably, I mean, obviously getting through selection was amazing time, but it's, I think without putting a name on a task, it's saving someone's life, saving the lives that we did. What people never, ever talk about. Everybody thinks that you hear about the military and it's all about, oh, you're trained to kill. It's far from it. You're trained to save lives, and that's what we did. We did a lot of it. And there's no greater pleasure than coming away from somewhere where you know you've changed a policy that's going to save hundreds of thousands of lives, or you've saved a particular life, you know? Especially when the chips are down and you think time's against you, everything's against you, and even yourself on the operation, you think, well, we're probably going to do this. And then all of a sudden it works out and you just walk away and you think, well, that's great. Well, they're the good times. They're the real good times, you know. In the cold light there, we sit there and go, how the hell did we get away with that? How did we do that? And it's a good result.
The book is called The Hard Way. It's by Billy Billingham, otherwise known as Mark Billingham. It's out now on Simon & Schuster. Billy, if people want to find you, I know you're on the social media, where can they get in touch with you?
Yeah, through Instagram or Facebook for sure. And, yeah, just reach out on there. And I try to speak to everybody that reaches out to me that I can. So you can follow where I'm at, where I'm going. I do a number of tours, which I've got a few in November coming up, if COVID allows it. I'm not really sure at the moment. And then there will be more tours coming up after the new year, once everything calms down. So, yeah, just follow the social media.
And who knows, we might be able to tempt you to come over and do a bit of a tour in Spain at some point.
I'd love to. I didn't realise you were in Spain, but yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. I'm looking across the Mediterranean at the moment. I think it'd be just the place for you to come and whip a few of us into shape. The book is called The Hard Way. It's by Billy Billingham. Check him out on the social media. It'll be is available to download on the TRE Bookstore as well. Billy, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure.